Nobel Peace Prize.
The South's schizophrenia over how to deal with the North is occasionally acted out in a kind of kabuki theater on the border between the two Koreas. There, defectors launch balloons bound for their homeland with messages intended to offend Kim Jong-il. The leaflets describe him as a drinker of pricey imported wine, a seducer of other men's wives, a murderer, a slaveholder, and the devil. I attended one of these balloon launches and watched police from Lee's government struggle to protect a North Korean defector named Park Sang-hak from angry unionists and university intellectuals who insisted that non-threatening engagement with Kim's government was the only permissible policy. Before it was over, Park kicked one of the counter-protesters squarely in the head, a blow that sounded like a bat whacking a baseball. He spat on several others. He pulled a tear gas revolver from his jacket and fired it into the air before police grabbed it. He failed to stop his opponents from ripping apart most of the bags containing anti-North Korean leaflets. In the end, Park's group managed to launch just one of its 10 balloons, and tens of thousands of leaflets were spilled onto the ground. Shin and I met for the first time on the day after that balloon debacle. He had not attended. Street confrontation was not his style. He had been watching old films of the Allied liberation of Nazi concentration camps, which included scenes of bulldozers unearthing corpses that Adolf Hitler's collapsing Third Reich had tried to hide. "It is just a matter of time," Shin told me, "before North Korea decides to destroy the camps. I hope that the United States, through pressure and persuasion, can convince the North Korean government not to murder all those people in the camps." Shin had not figured out how to pay his bills, make a living, or find a girlfriend in South Korea. But he had decided what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. He would be a human rights activist and raise international awareness about the existence of the labor camps. To that end, he intended to leave South Korea and move to the United States. He had accepted an offer from Liberty in North Korea, the nonprofit that sponsored his first American trip. He was moving to Southern California.
Chapter 23. USA. On a cool, late summer evening in an oceanside suburb of Los Angeles, Shin stood in front of a small audience of Korean-American teenagers. Dressed in a red T-shirt, jeans, and sandals, he looked relaxed and smiled sweetly at the attentive kids seated in stackable chairs. He was the featured speaker at the Torrance First Presbyterian Church. His topic, as always in public appearances, was life in Camp 14. For more than a year, his sponsors at Link had been sending him to this kind of event and nagging him to prepare appropriate remarks. They wanted him to deliver a crisply organized, emotionally powerful speech, preferably in English, that would use his unique story to shake up American audiences, motivate volunteers, and perhaps raise money for the cause of North Korean human rights. As one of Link's executives told me, "Shin could be an incredible asset for us in this movement. You could be the face of North Korea," we tell him. Shin was not so sure. On that night in Torrance, he had not prepared anything. After he was introduced by a Link staffer, he said hello to the students in Korean and asked, through a translator, if they had any questions. When a girl in the audience asked him to explain how he escaped, he looked pained. "This is really private and sensitive," he said. "I try to avoid talking about it as much as I can." Reluctantly, he told a story about his escape that was short, sketchy, sanitized, and largely incomprehensible to someone who was not steeped in the details of his life. "My story can be very heartbreaking," he said, wrapping up the session after about 15 minutes. "I don't want you to be depressed." He had bored and baffled his audience. One boy, clearly confused about who Shin was and what he had done in North Korea, asked a final question. "What had it been like to serve in the North Korean military?" Shin corrected the boy, saying he had not served in the Korean People's Army. "I was not worthy," he said. After watching his appearance in the church, I pressed Shin to explain what was going on. "Why do you want to be a human rights witness when it seems so difficult for you to talk in public about what happened in the camp?
Why do you leave out the parts of your story that could rile up an audience?
The things I went through were mine alone, he replied, not looking me in the eye. I believe most people will find it nearly impossible to know what I'm talking about. Nightmares, images of his mother's hanging, continued to haunt his sleep. His screams woke up roommates in the group house he shared in Torrance with Link volunteers. He refused free counseling from Los Angeles-based Korean-speaking psychotherapists. He declined to enroll in courses that could give him a high school equivalency degree. He refused to consider college. Several times during our long weeks of interviews, he mentioned a dead space inside him, which he said made it difficult for him to feel much of anything. Sometimes he pretended to be happy, he said, to see how other people reacted to him. Often he did not make any effort. Shin's adjustment to life in the United States had not been easy. Shortly after arriving in California in the spring of 2009, Shin began having severe and recurring headaches. His colleagues at Link worried that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. It turned out the headaches were a symptom of runaway tooth decay. A dentist performed root canal surgery. The headaches went away. That instant cure was the exception. There will be no quick, easy way for Shin to adapt to life outside the fence, whether in the United States or in South Korea. His friends told me as much, and so did he. Shin is still a prisoner, said Andy Kim, a young Korean-American who helped run Link and who for a time was Shin's closest confidant. He cannot enjoy his life when there are people suffering in the camps. He sees happiness as selfishness. Andy and Shin are about the same age, and they often ate lunch together at Los Chilaquiles, a cheap Mexican joint in a strip mall not far from Link's office in a Torrance industrial park. Shin was passionate about food and did his best talking in Korean and Mexican restaurants. For several months, Andy met Shin once a week for an hour to discuss how his life was shaping up in the United States. There were a number of good things going on. Shin had become chatty and playful in the office. He stunned Andy and others at Link by popping into their offices and telling them that he loved them. But he often did not respond well to advice from these same people, and had trouble distinguishing between constructive criticism and personal betrayal. Shin made little progress in learning how to manage money, sometimes spending more than he could afford on dinners and airline tickets for friends. In tearful conversations with Andy, he would describe himself as worthless garbage. Sometimes Shin sees himself through the eyes of his new self, and sometimes he sees himself through the eyes of the guards in the camp, said Andy. He is kind of here and kind of there. When I asked Shin if this was true, he nodded yes. I'm evolving from being an animal, he said, but it is going very, very slowly. Sometime I try to cry and laugh like other people, just to see if it feels like anything. Yet tears don't come. Laughter doesn't come. His behavior was consistent with a pattern that researchers have found among concentration camp survivors the world over. They often move through life with what Harvard psychiatrist Judith Lewis Herman calls a contaminated identity. They suffer not only from a classic post-traumatic syndrome, but also from profound alterations in their relations with God, with other people, and with themselves, Herman wrote in her book, Trauma and Recovery, an examination of the psychological consequences of political terror. Most survivors are preoccupied with shame, self-loathing, and a sense of failure. Soon after Shin arrived in California, Kyung Soon Chung, a pastor's wife born in Seoul, began cooking for him, mothering him, and monitoring his adjustment to American life. When he first showed up at her home for dinner, she ran to him and tried to give him a hug. He would not have it. He felt uncomfortable being touched. But he kept coming to dinner, in part because he loved Kyung's cooking. He also had become friends with Kyung's 20-something children, Eunice, a human rights activist he had met in Seoul, and her younger brother, David, a recent Yale graduate, also interested in human rights. The family, which has befriended a number of North Korean immigrants, lives in Riverside, a city 60 miles east of Torrance. Kyung and her husband, Jung-Hoon Kim, had a small Christian ministry called the Ivy Global Mission.
Shin discovered a Korean family that was open, welcoming, and loving. He was envious and a bit overwhelmed by the intensity with which they cared for one another and for him. For nearly 2 years, he spent every other Saturday evening at Kyung's dinner table. He slept over in a guest room and attended church with the family on Sunday. Kyung, who doesn't speak much English, began calling Shin her eldest son. He tolerated and then returned her hugs. He learned that she loved frozen yogurt, and before coming to dinner, he would stop at a supermarket and buy her some. She teased him, saying, "When are you going to bring me a daughter-in-law?" He flattered her, telling her that she was losing weight and looking younger. They talked for hours, just the two of them. "Why are you so nice to me?" Shin once asked her, his mood darkening. "Don't you know what I have done?" He told Kyung that he disgusts himself, that he cannot escape dreams of his mother's death, that he cannot forgive himself for leaving his father behind in the camp, and that he hates himself for crawling over Park's body. He said, too, that he was ashamed for stealing rice and clothing from poor North Koreans during his flight out of the country. There will be no end to Shin's guilt, Kyung believes, but she often told him he had a powerful conscience and a good heart. She also said he had an advantage over other North Koreans. He had not been contaminated by propaganda or the cult of personality that surrounds the Kim dynasty. "With Shin, there's a certain purity," she said. "He has never been brainwashed." Her children saw striking changes in Shin's confidence and social skills after a couple years in California. He was less shy, quicker to smile, and became something of a hugger. "Before and after some of my interviews with him in California, he hugged me too." "He used to be embarrassed meeting my church friends," said Eunice. "Now he knows how to make jokes. He laughs out loud." David agreed. "Shin shows real empathy for others, this thing called love. He may have quite a lot of love in there." Shin's self-assessment was less sanguine. "Because I am surrounded by good people, I try to do what good people do," he told me. "But it is very difficult. It does not flow from me naturally." In California, Shin began giving God all the credit for his escape from Camp 14 and for his good fortune in finding a way out of North Korea and China. His emerging Christian faith, though, did not square with the timeline of his life. He did not hear about God until it was too late for his mother, his brother, and Park. He doubted, too, that God had protected his father from the vengeance of guards. Similarly, guilt had not been an issue for Shin inside Camp 14. As an adolescent, he was furious with his mother for beating him, for risking escape, for causing his torture. He did not grieve when she was hanged. But as an adult survivor, as his emotional distance from the camp increases, his fury has given way to guilt and self-loathing. "These are emotions that slowly started to come out from within me," he said. Having seen firsthand how loving families behave, he cannot bear the memory of the kind of son he once was. Shin had come to Torrance with the understanding that he would help Link by working with its volunteers and speaking at its events. In return, Link provided him with housing and a living stipend, but no salary. With Link's help, he obtained a 10-year multiple-entry visa that allowed him to stay in the United States for up to 6 months at a time. U.S. immigration law grants special consideration to North Korean refugees, and Shin's unique status as a born and bred victim of a political prison camp gave him an excellent chance of obtaining permanent residency in the United States. But he did not apply for a green card. He could not decide where he wanted to live. Committing to anything was difficult. He enrolled in an English language course in Torrance, but dropped out after 3 months. He spent most of his time in Link's office, where he read North Korean news on the web and chatted with Korean-speaking staff. He was sometimes content to sweep floors, sort boxes, and carry furniture. He told Hannah Song, the executive director, that he should be treated no differently than any other staff member, but he also pouted about work assignments and succumbed to fits of anger. Every 6 months, his work was interrupted when he traveled back to South Korea for several weeks at a time. Link pushes the North Koreans it helps bring to the United States to make a life plan soon after they arrive. It is a list of practical, achievable goals that can help a newcomer build a stable, productive life. It usually includes English fluency, job training, counseling,
and lessons in money management. Shin refused to make a life plan, and Song said she and others at Link allowed him to get away with it. "His story is so powerful," said Song. "He felt entitled to be an exception, and we enabled him. He just floated around Torrance. He feels a need to make sense of why he survived that camp. I don't think he has figured it out yet." Outside of the Korean Peninsula, there's no place easier than Greater Los Angeles for a Korean to float around without learning another language. More than 300,000 Korean Americans have settled in and around the city. In Torrance and adjacent towns, Shin could eat, shop, work, and worship in Korean. He learned enough English to order burgers and Mexican food, and to talk about baseball and the weather with his housemates. He slept on a bunk bed in the 4-bedroom ranch-style house provided by Link, where up to 16 college-age volunteers and interns came and went. In the kitchen, on the day I visited, the dishwasher displayed a sign that said, "Please don't open. I am broken and I smell bad." The furniture was worn, the carpet faded, and the wide front porch was littered with sneakers, sandals, and flip-flops. Shin shared a cramped bedroom with 3 Link volunteers. The quasi-chaotic, dorm-like camaraderie suited him. Although his American-born housemates were sometimes noisy, spoke little Korean, and never stayed around very long, he preferred their energetic transience to living alone. It was a lingering effect of the life he had known in Camp 14. He slept better and enjoyed food more when surrounded by people, even if they were strangers. When he struggled to fall asleep in the group house or when nightmares woke him up, he crawled out of his bunk and slept as he had in the camp, on a bare floor with a blanket. Shin bicycled to work. It was an easy 20-minute commute through Torrance, a sun-soaked, industrial, suburban, multicultural mishmash of a place. Located 19 miles southwest of downtown Los Angeles, it is a fine stretch of beach on Santa Monica Bay, where Shin sometimes went for walks. The wide avenues of Torrance were drawn up a century ago by Frederick Law Olmsted Jr., who helped design the mall in Washington. The Mediterranean Revival facade of Torrance High School was the backdrop for TV's Beverly Hills 90210 and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Torrance also has an ExxonMobil refinery that churns out much of Southern California's gasoline. Before living in the group house, Shin spent much of his first year in Torrance in an aging, overcrowded 3-bedroom garden apartment that Link rented near a vast oil storage depot called the ConocoPhillips Torrance Tank Farm. Link moved to Torrance from Washington, D.C. to find cheaper rent and to focus on building a grassroots movement. It viewed Southern California as a better place to recruit and house the young volunteers it calls nomads. They are trained in Torrance to travel across the United States, give presentations, and raise awareness about human rights abuses in North Korea. At the end of Shin's second summer in California, one of those newly arrived nomads in training was Harim Lee, a slim, strikingly attractive young woman who was born in Seoul and moved to the United States with her family when she was 4. She attended high school in the suburbs of Seattle and was a second-year student studying sociology at the University of Washington when she first saw Shin in a YouTube video. He was speaking in an auditorium in Mountain View, California, answering questions about his life from people who worked at Google. She also found the Washington Post story I wrote about Shin, which quoted him saying he would like to have a girlfriend, but didn't know how to find one. Harim, who is bilingual, had traveled back to South Korea to work briefly as a translator for an NGO, or non-governmental organization, that focused on North Korea. After her 3rd year in college, she decided to leave school and get involved full-time in the North Korean issue. She learned about Link's Nomad program on the web. She did not realize that Shin was living in Torrance until 2 weeks before she flew from Seattle to start at Link. On the flight to Los Angeles, she could not stop thinking about Shin. She regarded him as a celebrity and prayed on the plane that they would become close. In Torrance, she soon spotted him cruising into Link's office on his bicycle and made it her business to find a time and a place where they could talk. They liked each other immediately. He was 27, she was 22. Link has a strict no-dating rule between North Korean refugees and interns, many of whom are college-age and far from their parents.
The rule is intended to protect both the interns and the refugees and ease the management challenges of the Nomad program. Shin and Harim ignored the rule. When they were warned to stop seeing each other until she finished her internship, both became angry. Harim threatened to quit. "We made a big deal to show that we felt the rule was wrong," she told me. Shin viewed the warning as a personal insult. He complained of a double standard that made him a second-class person and noted that his confidant, Andy Kim, was dating an intern. "It is because they thought so little of me," Shin told me. "They thought they could rule my private life." After a trip to South Korea and several months of brooding, Shin quit Link. His relationship with Harim was not the only reason behind the break. Hannah Song was frustrated that Shin sometimes avoided responsibility, expected special treatment, and made little effort to learn English, which limited his usefulness as a spokesman in the United States. There was also miscommunication about housing. As Shin heard it, Link would no longer provide him with a place to live. Song said she had told Shin that at some point he would have to find a place of his own. The strain was probably inevitable. It certainly was not unusual. In South Korea, North Korean defectors routinely quit their jobs, claiming that they have been singled out for persecution. At Hanawon, the resettlement center in South Korea, job counselors say that workplace paranoia, stormy resignations, and lingering feelings of betrayal are chronic problems as North Koreans adjust to new lives. Many of them never land on their feet. In the United States, the pattern is similar. Cliff Lee, a Korean-born American who lives in Alexandria, Virginia, has provided housing to several North Koreans in recent years and seen a pattern in their adjustment troubles. They know that everything they were told in North Korea was a lie, and they have a very tough time in America believing anything that an organization says. Song was heartbroken by Shin's decision to quit. She blamed herself for not demanding, when he first arrived in California, that he take responsibility for himself. Her main worry, she said, is not knowing what Shin is planning to do for the rest of his life. Epilogue. No escape. In February 2011, days after his break with Link, Shin flew up the West Coast to Washington State. He moved in with Harim and her parents in Sammamish, a Seattle suburb in the western foothills of the Cascade Mountains. His sudden relocation surprised me. I was also worried, like his friends in Los Angeles, that he was being impulsive and burning bridges without good reason. But his move certainly simplified the logistics of spending time with him. I happened to be from the state of Washington. After leaving Tokyo and the Washington Post, I had moved back to Seattle to work on this book. When Shin telephoned me at home and told me in broken English that he had become my neighbor, I invited him over for tea. Our work together was nearly done, and Shin had kept his word. He had allowed me to move around in the darkest corners of his past. But I needed a bit more, a better sense of what he wanted in the future. As he sat with Harim on the couch in my living room, I asked if I could visit their home. I wanted to meet Harim's parents. Shin and Harim were too polite to say no. Instead, they said the house was too messy. They would have to check on a good time. They would get back to me. Without saying so, they made it clear that they would prefer that my long interrogation come to an end, and soon. He and Harim had formed a two-person NGO called North Korea Freedom Plexus. To fund it, they hoped to raise money from donations, and he intended to give a lot of speeches. Their ambitious mission was to open asylum shelters for defectors who crossed into China and to smuggle anti-regime pamphlets into North Korea. To that end, Shin said he had twice traveled to border areas inside China and planned to do so again. When I asked if he was afraid of being abducted or arrested in China, where North Korean agents are known to hunt down and kidnap defectors, he said he has the protection of a South Korean passport and that he is always careful. But this was not an answer that satisfied friends who warned him to stay out of China. Lowell and Linda Dye, the Columbus couple who read my first story about Shin in 2008 and helped pay for his travel to the United States, were disappointed and worried when they heard that he had quit Link and moved to Seattle. The Dyes and the Kim family in Riverside, California, have told Shin that creating a new NGO is a risky idea,
and that he would be more effective if he continued to work with a well-established and well-funded organization. Shin has become close to the Dais. He calls them his parents and takes their concerns seriously. After he moved to Seattle, he accepted an invitation to travel to Columbus and stay with them for a couple of weeks, while Harim stayed home in Seattle. The Dais wanted to help Shin make a plan for managing his future. Lowell, a management consultant, believes he needs an agent, a money manager, and a lawyer. But in Columbus, he and Shin did not have a serious talk, in part because Shin kept Seattle hours, sleeping in until late morning and staying up at night to talk to Harim on Skype. "He told us he really loves Harim," Lowell said. "That is the way he is going. She makes him happy." When Shin returned to Seattle, I met again with him and Harim. Their house was still too messy, they said, for me to visit, so we had coffee at Starbucks. When I asked how their relationship was going, Harim blushed, smiled, and looked lovingly at Shin. Shin did not smile. He did not want to talk about it. I persisted, reminding him that he had often told me he did not consider himself capable of love, certainly not of marriage. Had he changed his mind? "We have to work before anything else," he said. "But after work is done, there is hope for progress." The relationship did not work out. 6 months after he moved in with Harim, Shin called me to say they were splitting up. He did not want to talk about why. Shin flew the next day to Ohio to live with the Dai family. He was not certain where he would go from there, perhaps back to South Korea. While Shin was still in the Seattle area, he invited me to a Korean-American Pentecostal church in the city's northern suburbs. He was giving a speech and seemed especially eager that I come and listen. When I showed up at the church a few minutes early on a cold and rainy Sunday evening, he was waiting for me. He shook my hand with both of his, looked me in the eye, and told me to sit in a pew near the front. He was dressed more formally than I could remember seeing him, a gray business suit, a blue dress shirt open at the collar, polished black loafers. The church was full. After a hymn and a prayer from the pastor, Shin strode to the front of the church and took command of the evening. Without notes, without a hint of nerves, he spoke for a solid hour. He began by goading his audience of Korean immigrants and their American-raised adult children, asserting that Kim Jong-il was worse than Hitler. While Hitler attacked his enemies, Shin said Kim worked his own people to death in places like Camp 14. Having grabbed the congregation's attention, Shin then introduced himself as a predator who had been bred in the camp to inform on family and friends and to feel no remorse. "The only thing I thought was that I had to prey on others for my survival," he said. In the camp, when his teacher beat a 6-year-old classmate to death for having 5 grains of corn in her pocket, Shin confessed to the congregation that he didn't think much about it. "I did not know about sympathy or sadness," he said. "They educated us from birth so that we were not capable of normal human emotions. Now that I am out, I am learning to be emotional. I have learned to cry. I feel like I am becoming human." But Shin made it clear that he still had a long way to go. "I escaped physically," he said. "I haven't escaped psychologically." Near the end of his speech, Shin described how he had crawled over Park's smoldering body. His motives in fleeing Camp 14, he said, were not noble. He did not thirst for freedom or political rights. He was merely hungry for meat. Shin's speech astonished me. Compared to the diffident, incoherent speaker I had seen 6 months earlier in Southern California, he was unrecognizable. He had harnessed his self-loathing and used it to indict the state that had poisoned his heart and killed his family. His confessional, I later learned, was the calculated result of hard work. Shin had noticed that his meandering question-and-answer sessions were putting people to sleep, so he decided to act on advice he had been resisting for years. He outlined his speech, tailored it to his audience, and memorized what he wanted to say. In a room by himself, he polished his delivery. Preparation paid off. That evening, his listeners squirmed in their pews, their faces showing discomfort, disgust, anger, and shock. Some faces were stained with tears. When Shin was finished, when he told the congregation that one man, if he refuses to be silenced, could help free the tens of thousands who remain in North Korea's labor camps, the church exploded in applause. In that speech, if not yet in his life, Shin had seized control of his past. This concludes the reading of Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West by Blaine Hardin. Copyright 2012 by Blaine Hardin. This book was read by Blaine Hardin. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Viking, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated, and was produced in 2012 by Blackstone Audio Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665 for a complete listing of our titles. Visit our website at www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.